Long time ago, there was a king, King Xerxes. He ruled over a large kingdom, and he was having a celebration one day. And he was celebrating all of the things that he had gained, and he was showing off all of his splendor and his wealth, all the sparkly things that he had gained. At this party, the wine was served in goblets that were made of gold. That's a fancy party, isn't it? And every goblet was uniquely fashioned so that no two were alike. Now, this king had a beautiful queen, Queen Vashti. And she was a trophy queen. You know, some men have their trophy wives. Well, he had a trophy queen. So on the seventh day of the celebration, he sent for her so that he could show her off as well. But she refused. She said no. Kings aren't used to hearing that word. Men, period, don't like that word, right? She said no. What's he going to do? Now he's embarrassed. He's angered. So he calls together his lawyers. And he gets them together and he says, what can we do to her? So these experts of the law, they looked at this situation and they came to the conclusion, we can't let this slip out. Because if other women learn that she said no and got away with it, they'll learn that it's okay. That's not bad logic, huh, guys? Well, somewhere along the line, someone let it slip down, didn't they? And they're pretty good at saying no. So they gave her advice, and I believe the idea of their advice is captured well in these lyrics from a Ray Stevens song. So get on out of here, go away, and let me be. Leave me by myself and set me free. I want to be alone and on my own, so get gone. Don't you even telephone. Hit the trail, move it out. Adios, arriba, dirty, chow, chow. Don't you ever try to come back. I'll be the same. You know what that means? That's bye-bye. I think that pretty much sums up what they asked him to do. They said, kick her out. Kick her to the curb. Get rid of her. So the search for a new queen begins. And we have a BC version of The Bachelor. You know that show? And they have this contest, and they have numbers and numbers of young female virgins that are hoping to get their chance to be the queen. Well, years before this story takes place, we have to catch up a little bit on where the Israelites are in history. King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, he had conquered Israel. And Israel had been conquered, and they'd been under the rule of Babylon until Babylon got conquered by Persia. So then the Israelites were under the rule of the Persians. And King Xerxes was a Persian king. So at this point in time, the Israelites had been scattered. They'd been in exile for many years. They'd been abused. They weren't the militant, vibrant nation they once were. And among these scattered people, there was a woman. Her name was Esther. Both of Esther's parents were dead. And we are told that she was raised by her cousin Mordecai. And that he raised her as his very own. And we're also told that Esther was a hottie. I mean, that's there. If Wayne and Garth or they had anything to say about it, they'd say that she was a babe, right? If she were president, she'd be called Babraham Lincoln. Thank you. Or Roy Orbison would have said she was a pretty woman, right? ZZ Top, they'd have said she's got legs. Well, she made it past the first round of judges. She made it past the second round of judges. She made it into the semifinals, and she made it past the semifinals. She made it to the finals, and she was crowned queen by the king Xerxes. And they had a new queen now. Now, through all this, she had not revealed her ethnic background, because her cousin, her stand-in father, Mordecai, had advised her not to let them know that she was a Jew. Now, after all this happens, a man named Haman comes into play. We've got our three main characters here, or actually four main characters. Haman comes in, and he is raised up to the highest position in the palace. And so emerges our antagonist in our story. Stories have to have antagonists, right? We talked about story last week. So we have our antagonist. Now, King Xerxes even issued a command that everyone was to bow down before Haman, because he was that high in the palace. And everyone did. Everyone bowed down before Haman except Mordecai. Mordecai, and this really upset Haman. It really burned him up. It irritated him to no end. And so when he found out that Mordecai was a Jew, he thought, well, I'll just get the king's permission to kill all the Jews, and then I can get rid of Mordecai, and then I can be a happy man. So he goes to the king, and the king gives him his signet ring so that any law or decree that he would have written, he could put that signet ring on there, and it would go out with the authority of the king. So Haman gathered together those who wrote the laws and made a law that the people in each province under the kingdom of King Xerxes would attack the Jews and destroy them. And this decree was sent out over all the land that was owned there by them. When Mordecai heard about this, he ripped his shirt, he ripped his pants, he put on rags, which are called sackcloth in the Old Testament, ashes, dirt, and he went through the town wailing and crying out loudly and bitterly. And in each of the other provinces that the edict went out to, there was similar behavior from the Jews. So Mordecai sends his word to Esther. He says, Esther, you got to use your position. You're the queen. You got to save us. You got to save your people from what the king has done. Well, Esther then sends a message back to Mordecai and says, I can't go before the king unless he summons me, because I could suffer death if you just walk in and see the king. So then Mordecai gives her some accountability, we'll call it. He tells her, he said, don't forget who you are. Don't forget where you came from. Don't forget whose people you belong to. You're part of God's chosen nation that has been scattered and abused for years. You are a Jew like the rest of us, no matter where you lay your pretty head. And then he tells her in chapter 4, verse 14, he says, for if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. So Esther sends word back to Mordecai and says, gather the Jews together and pray for me. Lift me up. Support me in prayer. And a few days later, Esther gets all dressed up and in her royal robes, and she goes in to see the king. And the king gives her permission to approach without having to suffer death. Kind of nice. He asked, he said, what can I do for you? I would give you up to half my kingdom. And so she says, I'd just like to have dinner with you and Haman. I'd like to cook you dinner. So he agrees. And she cooks a banquet for them. And it's her and the king and Haman. And at that banquet, the king asks again. He says, what is it you want, queen? What is it I can do for you? She said, well, I'll tell you what. Return and let me cook you another dinner tomorrow night, both you and Haman, and I'll present my request to you then. Another dinner. What man would say no to a woman offering food? Really? Much less we're talking about a hottie offering a banquet. Duh. Of course you're going to say yes and go back again. So they go their separate ways. And Haman is just on cloud nine. You know, he got to have dinner, a banquet with the queen and the king. And no one else was invited but him. All right? As if his head wasn't big enough. So he's going out and he's bragging to his friends and his family, and he's all excited, and life would be grand. But on his way home, he passed by Mordecai. Mordecai won't bow before him, and we know that irritates him. It makes him so mad. So when he came home and he was bragging to his friends and family, he had to include in there, you know, I can't enjoy all this fortune that's been brought my way because of that Mordecai. He makes me so angry. So his friends and his family, they give him a suggestion. Why don't you build a gallows 75 feet high? That's pretty tall there. From the floor to the ceiling, we're guessing it's probably about 30 to 35 feet. So if you can imagine a gallows over twice as high as that distance, that's a high gallows. This is pretty extreme. And they said, on these high gallows, you build this high gallows today, and then tomorrow morning you go in there first thing and you ask the king for permission to hang Mordecai on those gallows. He thought it was a good suggestion. So he took it. He built the gallows and he went to sleep that night. Well, as he was sleeping that night, the king was not sleeping. The king couldn't sleep. Something had gotten him. And so he goes and he has one of his servants read to him the record of his reign. And as this chronicler is telling him about these different things, they come across a story of how Mordecai had saved the king's life. See, Mordecai earlier in the book had overheard some people plotting to kill the king. Well, he reported to Esther. Esther reported to the king and saved his life. And he said, was anything done to honor this man for saving my life? And he said, no, nothing's been done. So he goes on to bed. Next morning, actually, I guess he stayed up all night long. In Scripture, we're led to believe that, because he asked, who's outside in my court? And they said, well, it's Haman. He's come to see you. Well, we all know what Haman's there to do, right? He's there to ask permission to kill Mordecai. So he's in there, and before Haman gets to open his mouth, the king comes out there, and he says, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? Now, Haman, being the humble soul that he is, he thinks to himself, surely he's talking about me. Surely, because I'm the best guy around. Everybody loves me. Everybody bows down, except Mordecai. But everybody bows down before me. Surely he wants to honor me for some amazing thing that I did for him. So he thinks for a minute. He says, well, you know, if you want to honor a man, you dress him in kingly robes, robes that you have even worn. And you put him on a horse that the king has ridden, and you would deck that horse out. You'd outfit the horse, and it would have the crest of the king placed on his head. And then what you'd do is you'd lead him through the city, and you'd have someone walking in front of him announcing that this is done for the man the king delights to honor. Yeah, I think that would do it. You know, he's thinking pretty good. The king tells him to go and gather the very things that he just requested, and to put Mordecai on the horse. And he was to lead him around town, announcing before him that this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Isn't that great? Let's put ourselves in Haman's feet for just a minute. That would be awful. Lead this guy around, you're just going to go get him killed. You just built 75-foot gallows for him, and you're leading him around town. So he's awful. He feels bad. He gets done with that. He just runs home. He closes the door, or actually locks the doors, closes the blinds, curls up in the fetal position, sticks his thumb in his mouth, and you can hear him muttering words of ill intent about Mordecai under his breath. Well, he's sitting there, and he's moping, and all of a sudden, knock comes on the door, and he's summoned to the dinner he had agreed to go to. Okay, so he's cleaning up, getting himself all together. He goes on over there, and they're having their dinner. And it's him and the beautiful Queen Vashti and King Xerxes, and she's cooked another banquet for him. And as they're talking, I can imagine that Haman was stuffing his face. And just from what little we're given about his character in this story. You know, just big old turkey leg, hand reaching for a second of mashed potatoes, right? Well, as they're talking, Esther shares her request with the king, and she tells the king, I'd like for you to spare my life and to spare the lives of my people. And this takes the king by shock, because up till now, he doesn't know that she's a Jew. He says, well, who's threatening your life? Who's threatening the lives of your people? And here's Haman over here talking. I can just imagine he froze in mid-bite at this next moment. You know, he just, you know. Because she turns, she points, she says, the enemy is this vile Haman. Oh, the king got so angry he couldn't even sit at the table. He got up and he went in the garden. He's gone for a few minutes. Now Haman, not knowing really what to do, he didn't really have much he could do. So he's begging, probably the worst thing he could have chosen to do, but he's begging Queen Vashti. He's begging for his life. And we're told that the scene here is set. She's reclining on a couch. And he's begging for his life. If you can imagine any kind of position, a guy would be in begging for his life, either right at the edge, you know, reaching up, grabbing her hands, or maybe leaning over, just asking her. Either way, this is not a good position to get caught in when the king comes back in. Because the king comes back in, and he says, I quote Scripture, he says, will he even molest the queen while she is with me in my house? Oh, Haman. Just bad choice after bad choice. So the king sends Haman out, and someone tells him, hey, there's a fresh gallows prepared. And true story, Haman is hung on the gallows he built for Mordecai. Isn't that great? Isn't it great when the bad guy gets it that bad He got humiliated in front of the whole city, and then he gets hanged on the gallows that he built for his enemy, his arch rival. You know, I enjoy this story. I enjoy this story for many reasons. It's just jam-packed with things that we can gain from it and learn from it. One of the things that I see in this is a power that's found in this story. A power that's involved in doing life together. A power that wouldn't be in this story if it weren't for the understanding of functioning as a we. That word we've been looking at this month, we. See, Mordecai empowered Esther. He raised her as his own. He gave her advice and information. He guided her and strengthened her. And he did all these things, and they empowered her to be who she was. He empowered her to accomplish the things that she accomplished. The ability to empower others is a potent quality to have. Thinking about this potent ability of empowerment, it makes me think of a certain number. The number 9 comes to mind. I believe that Carson Palmer, the quarterback of the Cincinnati Bengals, or any good quarterback for that matter, I mean, you take your pick. But what really separates a good quarterback from a great quarterback, I mean, you've got skills, you need skills. You got to be able to think on your feet. You got to be able to be athletic. All those things you can make a good quarterback out of. But a distinct part that sets aside the great quarterbacks from the good ones is the ability to empower the others on their team, right? I use Carson Palmer as an example because you very rarely see him run the ball himself. It's a last resort for him. You very rarely run a touchdown and get a chance to dance the end zone dance, right? He's constantly setting others up to be the victor. He's letting others make the first down, letting others score a touchdown. What are you saying? We all need to become quarterbacks? No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just bringing a quarterback because that's the most visible piece. See, a good team is made up of team members that continually empower each other. You could take any sports team and divide up the different positions, and if they're a good team, you can look at each position and see how they're empowering other positions so that they can do their job that much better. So what I'm saying is, no matter what your gifts are, no matter what your personality is, you can be used to empower others and just see amazing events happen for the kingdom of God. I believe it's really very simple. As we look at this story in Esther with Mordecai, we look at how Mordecai empowers Esther. And we can gain some things from that. If you want, go and pull out your bulletin. Pull out a pen or pencil. We're going to take just a few notes there, and you're filling those blanks. Some things that we can do, that we can learn from Mordecai on how we can empower others simply. The first part of this is to pour into the lives of others. Just pour yourself into other people. Don't be selfish or greedy. Just give. Just give what you got. Give who you are. Pour yourself into the lives of others. And the best resource you can give is love. Let me say, love. 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 Just love on people. Care for them. Show concern for them. Watch out for them. Protect them as if they were your own. And after you've loved, 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 let me tell you, love some more. You can't love enough. You really can't. When you get down to the basics of being a Christian, it's about love. In addition to that, you want to give tools for success. Tools for success. Anything you have that you can offer someone else that would build them up, that would make them more successful at the ventures that they are involved in the kingdom. Just hand it over. Whatever you got, I'm not talking about material, you know, it's not stick up. O.J. Simpson here. But just hand over what you got, information, inspiration, your testimony, encouragement, advice to protect them, and information to propel them. After you've poured yourself into somebody, then the next step is to kindle. We need to kindle their spirit towards good works for God. You invest in someone, you pour into them, and then you got to kindle them. In Hebrews 10, verse 24, it says, "And let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds." Let us consider. The writer of Hebrews there is saying, let's just imagine, just be creative with ways that you can encourage other people, spur one another, kindle that. The ways we can do that, accountability, that kindles a spirit. When you know you're going to be accountable to someone, when you know someone's going to ask you, "Did you do it?" That kindles a spirit forward. Encouragement, we've talked about that. Encouragement kindles a spirit. Another very basic thing, something we can't ignore, is prayer. Where are they? Accountability, encouragement, and prayer. There we go. These are very basic. And they're very easy to do. But they yield such an amazing product, such an amazing return. And you can see this list in the life of Mordecai in this story. You look back over it. I mean, he loved Esther. He raised her as his own. He was concerned for her. Go and read the book yourself. I had to skip a bunch of different things. But you can watch. He's always looking after her. He's watching her, looking at her. He's getting as close as he can, trying to keep in touch with her. He's concerned about her. He goes to protect her. He holds her accountable. He encourages her. And he prayed for her, lifted her up, and supported her in prayer. As we look at this story of Esther, we see the potency of empowerment. And it didn't stop with the death of Haman. Actually, that was the beginning of the avalanche of blessings for the Israelites. After that, King Xerxes gives Haman's estate. Now, Haman was raised to the highest position in the palace, so it was probably a pretty nice estate. He gives it to Esther. Esther gives it to Mordecai. So Mordecai ends up coming out pretty all right. Before they hang Haman, they take away the signet ring that belongs to the king, really, but he had it. So, and then he gave it to Esther. So now Esther had the king's ring. She had the authority of the king given to her. In addition to that, Esther goes to Xerxes, King Xerxes, and she asks that he would pass a law that would counter Haman's edict, that would go against Haman's edict, that would protect the Jews from being destroyed. And he says, "You've got my ring. You write it. Write whatever you want in there." Can you imagine? That'd be great if we could go somewhere and someone said, "You know, is there anything in the store I can just have? Take it all." I mean, isn't that great? So she sits down with Mordecai and the royal secretaries, and they wrote up an edict that was sent out all over the kingdom, and it's found in Esther 8, verse 11. It says, "The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of any nationality or province that might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies." We're told that Mordecai leaves the king's palace dressed in royal robes. And all the Jews celebrated joyously. As time passed by, the Jews, they protected themselves. They retaliated with a mighty force. They killed some 75,000 enemies while in exile. Pretty amazing. And they hung 10 of Haman's sons. God used Mordecai to empower Esther. Empower her through Mordecai. No prophet went to Mordecai and told him what was going to happen. He just did it. He just empowered her because he loved her and he wanted to see her succeed. My question to you guys this morning, how many of us want to be involved in a story like this? It doesn't take a prophet coming in here and telling us we need to get on the ball. It just takes us realizing the necessity of learning how to empower each other for the kingdom. I believe this is a necessary quality for each of us to develop if we are going to unlock the power that was intended to come from this community we call church. The power that God intended to be displayed through his body, the body of Christ. We've been given a spirit of power, not of timidity. However, there is one very large piece that I fear stands in the way of this. A shackle that keeps you from entering into a lifestyle that empowers others. I think we're pretty stuck on ourselves, honestly. You know, I look at this story and I see the selfish acts of Haman. I see his self-centered life, and I can't help but reflect on myself. And on our world, on our community. And the danger that that kind of a life, that kind of an attitude causes. I mean, just to the unity of the body. That's not talking about some of these more mature things like power and potency. Folks, we got to get over ourselves and we need to lay ourselves down. I had an old professor in college. Old professor, little guy. He was way past retirement. He used to tell us, he said, "Stand on my shoulders. Stand on my shoulders." I always thought that was funny because this guy was like all of 5 feet, maybe 100 pounds, right? My wife's laughing. She knows who I'm talking about. He'd say, "Stand on my shoulders." And I'd get this visual of physically standing on this poor man's shoulders. And I'm thinking, buddy, you don't want me to do that. But then as I got the picture of standing on his shoulders spiritually, I was so humbled. This man had experience. He was well respected in the kingdom. He wasn't saying, "Let me lead you." He was saying, "Stand on my shoulders and reach higher than I've reached." What an attitude to gain. Many of us have come forward and we've given our life to Christ. And we've laid our life down. I fear that regrettably and shamefully, many didn't leave it there. Church, if we want to see these more mature pieces working together, be able to empower each other and hear stories like the story of Esther happen right here in our community, we're going to have to lay down. We're going to have to humble ourselves. We're going to have to get over ourselves and just love each other and empower each other and pour into each other and kindle each other and gain this thing called teamwork, this idea that Christ, that Jesus presented as the body. And it's going to take laying ourselves down for each other.